Welcome to 21. I'm Drew Lasker. I'm a family man, professional athlete, and business owner of Train Harder 21 and 21 Media. Yvonne Harris and I have teamed up and created this podcast to explore the life lessons that come along with being an athlete. Why 21? It's my jersey number and a key part to my great fortune and career. So it seems fitting for this podcast.
Hi, I'm Yvonne Harris. I'm a proud boy mom and an advocate for efforts that improve the lives of women and children. Experiencing success as an athlete or in any facet of life does not happen by accident. There must be clarity, intention, and the willingness to pivot. Our guests on 21 share their journeys in ways that cause you to reflect, assess, and then take action. We are so thankful for the stories shared on this podcast because Drew and I know their wisdom shortens someone else's path to success. Enjoy this episode of 21.
Welcome to another episode of 21, and I love crime. Wait, let me clarify. I love to watch the crime channel. Let me be specific. And when it comes to the local authorities and they hand the case over to the FBI, you know you're in for a good episode. I like to call myself a couch detective. Today, we bring you the real deal, as today's guest is a real life authority figure, as she spent 24 years as a special agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Now retired, she is the founder and director of Mental Toughness Center. We welcome Lorae Kwai. Lorae, welcome to 21.
Thank you, Drew. It's really an honor to be here. And thank you for asking me to be a part of your podcast.
We're glad you're here, Lorae. Okay, Mr. Couch Detective. Did we warm up a little bit with Lorae?
Yeah, let's warm her up a little bit. So, Lorae, we got a game we call 21 Questions with 21. So we're going to put you right in the hot seat. We're going to give you two options and you pick the best option. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. We start off easy. Whataburger or In-N-Out?
In-N-Out.
Beer or tequila?
Beer.
Beach or mountains?
Mountains.
Twitter or Instagram?
Instagram.
Tupac or Biggie?
What was that?
Two old musicians. We can skip by it.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay. You know, we're talking sports, Lorae, at some point. So Jordan or LeBron?
Oh, Jordan.
Popeyes or Chick-fil-A?
Chick-fil-A, I think.
Las Vegas or Miami?
Las Vegas.
Action or rom-com?
Action.
IHOP or Waffle House?
Waffle House.
East Coast or West Coast?
West Coast.
Early bird or night owl?
Early bird.
Car or truck?
That's a hard one. I love trucks, but I drive a car, so I guess I'd have to go with car.
Netflix or Hulu?
Netflix.
Sprite or Dr. Pepper?
I don't like either one.
Summer or winter?
Summer.
Xbox or PlayStation?
PlayStation.
Dishes or laundry?
I'll take laundry.
iPhone or Android?
iPhone.
Homemade or takeout?
Homemade.
And finally, Lorae, are you a club person or a house party gal?
I like house parties.
I concur.
Yeah.
And you're now off the hot seat.
Thank you.
That was fun.
This is fun. Yeah, made me think a couple of times there.
Of course, we try to put you on a little bit of pressure, but...
Oh, I know, especially the truck thing, because I grew up on a ranch, you know, and my first inclination is a red Chevy truck. So, you know, but I drive a car. So.
Well, I know for myself, after reading up about you, that I'm very intrigued in your story, and I'm sure our listeners are as well. So just to get us started a little bit, just tell us a little bit about your background.
Absolutely, Drew. I was just born and raised on a remote cattle ranch in the middle of Wyoming, and spent, you know, my first several years kind of going to a private school. And it wasn't because we were rich or anything. It was because it was that remote. The ranch was just that remote. So when I got into high school, it was the first time I actually went to a public school. And so it was rough, you know, I have to admit. I grew up around cattle and horses and dogs, and they were my friends growing up. And I had one brother, and that was it. So high school was a little tough, getting socialized, to be truthful. But I went on to school, University of Wyoming, for a year. Then I transferred to Arizona. And, you know, I've just never looked back. I love animals. And I still, to this day, if I hadn't become an FBI agent, I think I would have been a veterinarian, just because I love working with animals. And just all you have to do is show me a photo of a dog or a horse or even a cow, and I'm all over it. But what can I say? I have a real value. I value God's creators, God's creations, excuse me. So.
Yeah. And I did read about your love for animals, but did you play any type of sports growing up?
Well, it depends what you do qualify as sport. I first learned how to ride a horse when I was about 6 years old. So when I used to talk about sports, it was always with an animal. So I would ride horses and gather cattle. And I always wanted to be one of those that would go to the rodeo and compete barrel racing or pole bending or whatever it took to be with my horse. That was kind of, so sports in the traditional sense, no. But you know, I was out there doing things and I can rope. I don't know if you call that a sport, but just life on a ranch, I just really lived that. So I didn't have much opportunity for organized sports in school, unfortunately.
I consider those activities sports.
Well, when you learn how to ride a horse and when you get on a horse that knows how to cut cattle, I mean, you just point to the cow and the horse knows. I mean, you have got to be on it. So I've been left behind more than once when the cow turned 90 degrees, the horse turned 90 degrees, and I turned about, like, I don't know, I went straight ahead. You know, I just didn't quite make that cut, but.
And roping, I would say it's got to be more difficult than shooting a bat ball in a basket trying to. So I definitely.
Oh, no, I have played basketball. Drew, you have got it hands down. No, that takes talent. It doesn't take talent to rope, just takes practice. But what you do takes talent. There's a difference.
Well, you mentioned attending the University of Wyoming, Larae, and then going to Arizona. So walk us through your college journey and when you landed on the career decision to join the FBI. I'm so curious.
Yeah, I graduated with a bachelor's in business. And, you know, growing up on a ranch, I didn't have access to a lot of the fun, fancy things like fancy clothes or, you know, all the things that I could see on TV, but in my little hometown in Wheatland, Wyoming, they just weren't available. So when I was started interviewing, a couple of fashion stores were looking for, you know, managers, trainees, assistant buyers and that kind of thing. And I thought, oh my God, this is like, you know, I've just come into a candy store. This will be wonderful for me. What a great fit. And, I quickly learned that the reality is much different than the fantasy, right? I would come home dead tired at the end of the day or end of the month or the year. And I'd look back and I'd say, my biggest contribution was persuading women to buy polka dots instead of stripes. I mean, it kind of came down to that level and it just sucked the life out of me. So I went back to school at ASU and I was pursuing a master's in communication, actually. And the FBI came on campus. They were interviewing for new agents. And I said, why not? You know, even though I'd born and raised on a ranch, I had never shot a gun in my life. So they were expecting a lot of things from me that were different that I had never done before. But as I listened and they wanted to know my story, they wanted to know exactly kind of the questions you just asked me, you know, I greased balers during the summer, you know, I could fix fence, I could stack bales, you know, and later, not at the time, but later I realized that was one of the things I really liked about me. I didn't grow up entitled or spoiled or expecting an easy road, because they knew when I got done talking about getting thrown into a fence after the horse turned and the cow turned and I didn't a few times, that I knew how to survive, right? And so they pretty much offered me a job right on the spot. I had to take some tests, but it was a very short turnaround, and I realized that was very unusual. So I think they saw more in me than I saw in myself, to be honest with you at that point. But so I was just a few months short of finishing my master's, and they just said, you know, we're not going to wait. You know, you make a decision. It's the Bureau of the Knee. One thing you will learn is that the needs of the Bureau always come first, and it starts now. And it did. So I just said, fine, you know, and I just left it and found myself at Quantico, Virginia, the Marine Corps base. And that was when I realized that no matter how many bales of hay I had stacked or how many balers I had greased or how many fences I'd fixed, I was in another league. And it was a pretty rough learning curve, to be truthful.
Well, I appreciate how you were just open to something different, right? So I can just imagine you're at ASU, you're going through your master's program, and there were probably a number of employers that came to campus, you know, looking for, mm-hmm. you know, talented recruits like yourself. And you're just like, hey, FBI, that seems pretty interesting. So it's just like you took the road less traveled.
I did. And I truthfully did know what I was getting into, to be honest, because what I knew really was watching crime shows on TV or watching movies or reading
like
books.
Me.
I was going to say, Drew, exactly. And it's just a lot different. And I had to put aside what I thought I knew about how the FBI worked and really lean into the principles. Now, I will tell you that I didn't know why necessarily at the time, why the FBI spoke to me, but later, and I, like I said, my dad, my dad had a strong work ethic. And I mean, in my book, I talk about, you know, the biggest insult he could hurl at someone was to call him a wimp. I mean, you know, he was a cowboy. And a man with integrity, and I learned a lot from him. But internally, FBI stands for fidelity, bravery, and integrity. I didn't know that when I first interviewed, but something just connected between my heart and my head. And it was just knowing that I was working for an organization that had the same kind of values that I held important. And once I came to that understanding, that was what developed that core of steel that I needed to get through the academy, because the academy was really, really hard for me.
So when you arrived at Quantico, what was your position in entry? And then Lorraine, tell us about some of the roles that you had throughout your career.
Absolutely. The Marine Corps base. FBI is a paramilitary organization, you know, it just is. And so I'll have to tell you, the first day at the academy, we all stand up and introduce ourselves. And, you know, some guy over here had fought terrorists in North Africa. And there was some guy over here who was a lawyer in New York and helped bring down a mob. And another guy had survived a shootout in New Jersey. And I stood up and I said, I was a buyer at a fancy department store. And I mean, literally, heads just turned to get a look at the fluff ball that had accidentally gotten into the FBI. So I really started off on a, you know what I mean? And then things got really bad, because then I had to do the physical fitness test. And I, you know, I'm not a Drew. I'm not a natural athlete. And I had to really work hard in order to survive. But when I felt most desolate and not sure I'd made the right decision, I kept going back to, you know, what the Bureau stands for and how I could get behind that. And it wasn't just all about profit or loss or a spreadsheet. It was, you know, doing something that would impact people in a positive way.
So it sounds like you got in shape. For the physical fitness test. What were some of your greatest successes there? And maybe what were some of your greatest learning experiences?
Ironically, I will tell you, all of my best learning experiences were couched in adversity and my failures. And I when people ask me about my greatest failure, I know exactly where to go on that one, because again, the first few days at the academy, we took our fit test, physical indicator fit test, and I was that 1% that makes the other 99% possible. You know, I was just rock bottom. And the thing is, with physical fitness, everybody sees what you can and cannot do. Like if I and I was a very good shot, but only people who knew what I shot were those on either side of me. And when you take these tests, your instructors know, but physical fitness out there, I mean, if you're the last one in the 6 mile run, if you, you know, whatever. So I will say that one of our physical fitness tests, it was our interim, and you have to pass them. If you don't pass, you are washed out. It's just that simple. And they knew I had a particular problem with push-ups. My coach did. And so guess what? He was the one to count my push-ups. And everything was going fine until I got to about the 9th push-up. And then he just kept counting it to indicate, do it again, do it again. I must have done that 9th push-up 9 times before he finally counted it. And, you know, I'm just thinking, I am not going to have what it takes to make 50 at this point. And I didn't. I failed that test by 1 point. And I did face the real possibility of being washed out. But I will say that was probably my most important failure, because it really brought home what I wanted in life. If it hadn't meant that much to me, I wouldn't have struggled as much as I did. And I truly did struggle. And, you know, to be honest, and I don't, you know, criticize my classmates, but I was seen as the weak link. You know, and there's this thing, you know, when you're carrying a gun and when people are counting on you to show up in a responsible way, you are looked at, you're scrutinized. And I could tell there were a lot of questions in a lot of people's eyes of whether I could do it. So it was important to me to kind of come to that kind of come to Jesus moment where, you know, this is what I believe and this is the direction I want to take and this is what I'll do to get there. So that taught me a lot about perseverance. I know Drew knows a lot about that, and endurance, determination, focus on goals. But, you know, I would say that through that adversity was one of my greatest lessons. And that was to pursue something that's important to you. Because if it isn't important to you, you'll give up.
Yeah. And speaking of adversity, I look at 24 years doing anything as amazing. Let alone being part of the FBI. So just talk to us a little bit about the transition. When did you know that your run was over?
So I spent 20 years as a counterintelligence and espionage agent. And I spent most of that time in San Francisco, because at that time, the Chinese consulate and the Russian consulate were both very active centers of counterintelligence and spying in the United States. So that was San Francisco was a very good assignment. San Francisco and Washington, D.C. were the two best assignments if you're working, you know, espionage and counterintelligence. I sensed I needed something new and different and more. And so an opening came up to be the spokesperson for the FBI in Northern California. And I thought, well, that's different. That's different. That'll, you know, I just need those creative juices to start flowing again, right? I need the challenge. And so I did that for 4 years. And I just sort of sensed internally, it was time for me to move on. And even in high school, I'd always wanted to write. I mean, I've loved to write and I love to paint. And those are just two things I just really couldn't give much attention to working full time. And it was a very consuming job. So when I retired, and I was eligible, then I started writing, and that's kind of where I'm at these days. I'm having such a good time. Secrets of a Strong Mind, second edition just came out, and I just have fun at talking to people in a very normal voice and not some, you know, politically correct voice all the time, but just, you know, just be prepared for that shitstorm when it shows up, because it will show up. And the more prepared you are, the better able you're going to be to work your way through it. And this past year has really, I think, clarified that for a lot of people. Been a lot of things that didn't go according to plan. And those were good lessons I learned in undercover operations, particularly because they seldom go according to plan, just to prepare yourself mentally to pivot when you need to.
Okay, so now I have some questions. What do you like to paint?
Abstract. Right now as I'm painting abstract, and I love vivid colors. So I'm doing some really like purples and greens and you know, just things that when you look at them, I want people to smile. You know, it's not a deep thinking kind of portrait, you know what I mean? Or scenario. It's something, oh yeah, I sense that. One painting is called Into the Light. And it's just this ship with a sail coming into the light. And, you know, it can be whatever you want it to be, but, you know, I like for it to evoke a fun, happy emotion.
You'll have to share some of your artwork with us. We'd love
Absolutely.
To see it.
I'd love to. Are you kidding? That'd be awesome.
And then I have to ask, are undercover operations as cool and sexy as they seem?
Oh my God. You cut to the heart of it really fast there. I wish. So I will tell you a successful undercover story that almost fell to shit. But I leaned back into who I really am and I got through it. So if you want me to, I can give you this little story.
Go for it. Yes.
Okay. No, share it. Absolutely.
So again, it was my first office, which was back in Phoenix, which is where I was recruited from. And I'm a guy on a squad next to me was working undercover, and he wanted basically an arm charm to go with him to this barbecue. And his assignment was against this group of, it was an organized crime gang is what it was. And they were wanted for a number of extortions and a couple of murders. And I mean, you know, that was, and they traveled interstate, which is why the FBI got involved. And they were organized crime. So I said, oh, wow, that sounds exciting. I'd seen those movies. I'd seen those television shows. I could do this. So I left my gun at home and took a fake ID and showed up. And it was a rough crowd. But, you know, they were very friendly at first. And this small blonde woman met me at the door, and she took my handbag and took it into a bedroom. And then, you know, I went with my so-called date, and we're outside, and, you know, it's Phoenix, hot, and I, you know, I needed more sunscreen. So I went back in to get sunscreen, which was in my handbag. And when I went to the room where she had left it, I saw her, this small blonde woman, and another woman going through a bunch of stuff on a side table. And my handbag was one of them. So I reached in and pretend nothing was wrong. But I could tell they had searched my handbag. And at the same time, two guys walked in behind me and they closed the door. And so I was just there isolated with these four people. I had no idea where the undercover agent, which UCA is what we call them, where he was. They started peppering me with a bunch of questions. You know, who was I? How did I meet that guy I came with? And it wasn't in a particularly complimentary tone that they mentioned his name. And, you know, I just knew. I knew I was in trouble. And I knew that UCA was as well. So I knew I had to come across as being very authentic. I couldn't lie. I couldn't just... The UCA was trying to bullshit his way through all of this and trying to be this tough guy, you know, and it just didn't work. And they saw through that. And so I just told him everything about me. I said, I grew up in Wyoming. And I mean, for us, fast food was hitting a deer at 60 miles an hour. And, you know, if I didn't get out when I went to school, I'd be there now. And I just told him everything about me except my real name and that I work for the FBI. And I just told my love of horses and dogs. And the small blonde woman is the one who kind of nodded. And she said, you know, I understand. I'm from Kansas. And that's why I'm here. And instantly, us two of us just had a real, it was authentic bond, because she knew where I came from. And, you know, psychologically and philosophically. And so at some point, you know, the guys were the ones to ask the questions, but she was the one that called the shots. because at some point she just went to the door and opened it. I knew I was going to get out of that room unharmed and untouched, which was my goal. And we left soon thereafter, the undercover agent and I did. And about 2 weeks later, we got word that a hit had been placed on the undercover agent because they thought he was a member of a rival gang. And he was pulled from the operation. And no mention was ever made of me. I wasn't an active participant in that whole thing, but I just think my authenticity is what they saw. And so, you know, from that day on, I never went into any undercover operation trying to be anybody other than Lorraine. No matter what title they slapped on me or what name, I was always who I am at the core. And that's, I think, why my undercover operations were as successful as they were, because I wasn't trying to be anybody other than me. It was a tough first lesson. It was my very first undercover assignment, but I took that lesson with me for the rest of my career.
It reminds me, Lorraine, of this great movie I saw recently. Lifetime did a movie on Mahalia Jackson, the gospel singer.
Yeah.
And it's so well done. It's produced by Robin Roberts. But Mahalia had this saying, she says, "I take me wherever I go."
Oh, I love that.
And what you just said reminds me of that. So, you know, you've done these amazing things. You've had this tremendous career, but you were always true to yourself. You always showed up and you took yourself wherever you went.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Yvonne. That was, again, a very learning experience. Not necessarily a good one. It was very frightening at the time. But again, sometimes the things that stick with us are the best learning tools are the things that really, they're the things that get our attention. I mean, and something like that got my attention. Believe me, I knew I needed to come out of that room unharmed. So, well, yeah.
I mean, that's an amazing story. And it sounds like you have to have an incredible amount of composure and also mental toughness, which ironically you're a leading expert in. How do you personally define mental toughness?
Mental toughness is believing that you will prevail in your circumstances rather than believing your circumstances will change. And so no matter where I found myself, whether it was that undercover operation or some other situations where it wasn't always in my, things weren't always going my way. It was to be flexible enough to recognize, you know, is this ego keeping you moving forward in this direction? Or is this, are you moving forward because you truly believe in this? And if you truly believe in it, and if there's value and meaning behind what you're doing, you'll find the mental toughness to do what you need to do. It's plain old grit, you know, But Drew, I know you know this better than most. If you're not doing something you truly love, something you truly value, when things get tough, you're probably going to just do something else or move in a different direction. That's when, if you don't have that, then it's really hard to keep moving when things are tough and things are, do not come out according to plan. Like the undercover operation didn't go according to plan. So it's just, you know, how can you, but it was important. These guys were murderers and extortionists. I mean, they needed to be off the street. And so when you get in that moment, you don't use the path of least resistance. You move forward.
Yeah, I think you would be great in a professional athlete's locker room. Because, you know, being a professional athlete, you got to have mental toughness. I've seen players who've had it and I've seen players who don't, and you get washed away very quickly. Do you think it's something that you just have, or do you think it could be developed or taught?
You can definitely learn. Mental toughness is something you can learn. It's a mindset. And actually, I'm working on my book, Secrets of a Strong Mind, online sort of corporate training program based around that. But basically, mental toughness is, you can learn mental toughness because it's a mindset. It's the way you look at yourself. It's the way you look at adversity. It's looking at why you're doing what you're doing in the first place. I mean, we all know blue flamers out of college, right? And they are out there and they are ready to run over the people in front of him. And the older folks at that point start to look back and go, oh my God, they're nipping at my heels. I got to keep moving ahead to stay in place. I've got to keep moving, right? But then when we hit, I don't know, maybe 40s, somewhere in there, maybe late 30s, suddenly we're the ones getting nipped at our heels, right? Because the new bunch of people out of college or wherever they're from are nipping at our heels and want to overcome us. And it's like, at that point, we have to ask ourselves, you know, is this really important to me, what I'm doing? Because if it isn't, you know what you'll do, you'll give up and do something different. Failure is incredibly important. My thinking on failure is this. Most people stumble around, they find something they're good at, and that's where they stay, whether it's really taking them where they want to go in life or not. So success becomes mediocrity because you've never had the adversity to really push you to ask that question, is this really what I want? Is this what I really want to do and where I want to go? Because that will force you to reevaluate. And I just think that too often success leads to mediocrity because that's where we stay because it's comfortable.
Did you consider yourself to be mentally tough before you joined the FBI, like when you were in retail and helping women decide between polka dots and stripes? Or is it something that you really discovered about yourself once you joined the Bureau?
You know, I'm a big believer in that we all need to excavate the significance of our own stories and our own experiences. I wouldn't have called myself mentally tough until I really started to evaluate how my childhood experiences impacted and influenced who I am today. When I was that story I was telling you about, when I was, you just learned how to ride. In Wyoming, it's very much a cowboy kind of country. And so I had a brother and I assumed that he was always going to be the one to do the fun stuff, right? Because I like to get out there on horses and stuff. And my dad said, you know, I've got to go help a neighbor trail cattle about 30 miles. So it'll be about a 2-day trail. And I thought, sure, my brother would be chosen. But dad looked at me and he said, you saddle up, Sugar, my little horse, and you come. We're going on a cattle drive. And I was so excited. My God, I got to do the fun stuff. I was with the guys, you know? And so we rode our horses over there and the next morning got up and it was about 7 or 8 at the time. And I knew how to get my saddle on her because she wasn't a pony, but she wasn't a really big horse. So I could shove the saddle on her. And I did that all by myself, you know, and I was just marched so proudly in front of all the other cowboys. And then they all just got, you know, they got into their saddles, right? A lot of them would just swing up, you know, pull themselves up. And I'm going, oh my God, my stirrup was about where my nose is. You know, I mean, I had to find a rock or a chute or something to climb on so I could get on her. Cause I wasn't big enough to, you know, swing into the saddle on my own. And I didn't want to ask for help. I mean, you know, everybody was out there doing their own thing. And I said, oh my God. So anyway, so I led her to a corral and I stood on the poles and tried to just jump on her, right? She was sweet, but she wasn't stupid. So she would, you know, shy away. And I looked up there and all the guys are just, they're leaving. And these pastures are like maybe 2,000 to 3,000 acres each. This is big cattle country. And I knew once they got out the gate and started gathering, I wouldn't even know how to find them. And I kind of started to panic. And I thought maybe dad would look back and have pity on me and help me, but he didn't. He just rode out. So I was just there. And I was desperate by this time, right? And so this time when she started to shy away, I just jumped and I grabbed her her mane and I kind of just clambered on her neck and finally was able to get a foot over the saddle horn and pulled myself up and then trotted out to meet the guys. And my dad, he didn't say a word when I rode up right next to him, but he just gave me a quick nod of approval. And I mean, I remember that. It was not necessarily a kind experience, but on the other hand, it, from that moment, you just ask whether or not mental toughness can be learned. I think we all have incredible stories of strength if we will just go back and excavate them for ourselves. I can share my stories, but each of us needs to go in and find our own. So is it learned? Yes. But I think it's learned. We accrue that knowledge through our life. Oh, it's our, let me put it this way. It's our choice too.
So, Larae, we're entering the summer season. A lot of people try new things during the summer. And it takes 21 days to form a habit. Interesting. Drew's jersey number 21. He has a habit of winning, I guess. But give us some tactics. So give us just one. Like, what's one thing if someone said to you, Larae, I need to hone in on this skill. What could I do?
That's a great question. You know, for me, I love this concept of a petri dish. I mentioned earlier that successful people often find themselves in a level of mediocrity because they stay where they are and they don't push themselves into those discomfort zones. And what I encourage everyone to do is to create a petri dish. And that's that little space where it's experiments unknown. So if I wanted to do something, it's like, okay, I'll take singing lessons. How about that? I mean, but I can do it in a safe place. A petri dish allows us to, the best thing about a petri dish is that it allows us to understand how we react to failure. So if I burst into a bunch of tears or whatever, or if I just give up, or how do I find my way around that obstacle? And I encourage everybody to have a little petri dish and have several things in it, things where you're just as likely to fail as you are to succeed, because what you do need to know is how you will respond when you are confronted with the unknown, when you do face adversity or when something doesn't go wrong. You don't want to be sabotaged by your emotions, and that little emotional limbic brain is totally capable of sabotaging the thinking brain. There are times you just don't need that to happen, right? So experiment. Experiment before. Don't, you know, before you run into a situation where you're reacting, your response really is important. You want to respond rather than react.
Interesting. I'm going to actually sit in your chair and I'm going to get personal here. So I'm sat in your chair. Obviously, you're a mental toughness expert. I'm a 16-year pro, 38 years old, oldest player in the league. Obviously, my body isn't the same. How do I maintain my mental toughness at this stage of my career where I feel like I'm not the same physically?
You know, it's a great observation about yourself, to be truthful, because a lot of folks in your situation would just keep pushing on. And I'm not thinking against Tom Brady or anybody else, but you know, and Don Mickelson, right? He just got another championship at 50. So it's not impossible to keep moving. I think what's really important is to take time out occasionally and ask yourself, are you still getting really fed from what you're doing? And if you are, then you will be a Tom Brady or a Don Mickelson. If not, there could be an inner beckoning to do something a little different. I see you able to relate to people. You have an incredible story. And I know that you speak and you're a motivational speaker, but that's a great, great talent. And if you can just inspire one person, wow, that's quite an accomplishment. So I just think it's a great idea to ask yourself, is this really where, you know, to continue down this path, is it really still what is feeding you? And if it is, you will find a way to make it through. And if not, then the petri dish begins. I mean, it's like, how would this look if it were a little different?
That was great. I was just going to say, you can, I'll send you my address and you can send me the bill through.
I'm a big admirer of yours. I just, a person with your grace and your presence and your talent and your personality. It's a very nice little package. Congratulations.
Appreciate it, Larae. Thank you very much.
You also recognize gender differences as it relates to mental toughness. And I'm sure you're aware, Larae, that so many women are working through issues around the imposter syndrome, which connects to that topic. It's just maybe a negative outcome of that. But tell us a little bit more about your observations in terms of how women are, I guess, finding their way, finding their voice as it relates to mental toughness.
You know, interestingly enough, and I have done some coaching for executives, what I find, no matter the level of executive, is their confidence level. It's interesting to me that confidence, even you're talking to somebody who's a senior VP or a CEO, when something new comes up or they're confronted with, let's just use, we can use COVID as an example, how to force their employees back into the office or whatever, you know, that's just one example. But so for whatever reason, I do think women often find themselves faced with lack of confidence more than men. And I'm not sure why. And it could be a lot of society's pressures. You know, there's so many, there's so many pressures on women to stay in shape, to look good, to achieve, to be a parent, to volunteer. And a lot of the guys, I worked with primarily a lot of men in the bureau, they have a lot of the same pressures. I mean, don't get me wrong on that. And they may have the same, some of the same confidence issues, but I have always been struck by how women seem to lack the confidence that a lot of men do. And my biggest advice, best advice for those women, there's a couple of things actually. First of all, is to go back and own their successes. And that takes self-awareness. It takes time, again, excavating the significance of your own stories and experiences, where you go back and you claim ownership of a success, and where things were perhaps not going in your direction, but you made it anyway. And that's something we don't do. We don't take the time to go back and be self-aware and to dig down. I don't know if we're just afraid of what we'll find. Sometimes that is the case. And there's a lot of, let me tell you, I know better than most how hard it is to put a shine on a sneaker. So, you know, you have to work at this. And whether it's men or women, sometimes they're hesitant to do that. But I think when it comes to building confidence, that's essential. The other thing for women in particular, they're being fed a really big lie because they are told that they can multitask better than men. And so they're doing their damnedest to live up to that reputation, to live up to that image that is portrayed out there of women, you know, having five arms and doing 10 things. But it's not true. And neuroscience has proven that. Whether you're a man or a woman, multitasking simply doesn't work. And if you want to do something well, the brain needs to prioritize. And that's how every brain is, not male or female. So as far as this idea of having three priorities and working on them at the same time, it's not based in fact. It's a fantasy. And so if you really want to do something well, then narrow it down to the most important thing. Keep your focus on that. If something else comes up, there's an interruption, you give it a time to do this, a specific time, and you go back to what you need to do. So that would be one of my biggest pieces of advice I could give to women who are listening, is to really think about the way you've been told you can multitask better than a man, and you've bought into that lie, and that is what it is. Science will prove me right.
You have a mental toughness assessment. Tell us about that, and then some of your other resources as well. I'm sure our listeners are going to want to dive in.
Thank you. Yes, it is I have a mental toughness assessment that's free. And I encourage anybody who wants to take it to please just go to my website. It's available there. And it delves into behaviors and thoughts and emotions and how our emotions and our thoughts drive our behavior. To get the most out of it, it's important to be honest, not try to answer the way you think you want to be seen, but the way you feel, your own mindset, because that's the thing that holds people back. It's their own mindset, you know? And so then along with that, secretsofastrongmind.com is my book. And there's an online course that is being developed right now that we're working with CPAs. We're working with medical professionals, particularly the first responders, because they just need to understand how to create a mindset that can keep moving when man, they've just been inundated with stuff. And so those were a couple of resources I would encourage people. And my book, Secrets of the Strong Mind, as well. You can get that on Amazon.
Yeah, so for our listeners out there, that is LaRaeQuai.com, where you can get that free assessment. And also read your blog on there as well, which I enjoyed reading a couple. But if you can go back and speak to a younger LaRae, what would you tell her?
I thought about that so many times. I played it safe so many times, Drew. And I wished I had taken time, even before I went to college, to just do something with volunteer work, just go abroad, to learn about people who have it far worse than even the worst people in the United States. I mean, there are billions of people who have it so much worse off than we do. And if I had just understood that a little earlier in my life, if I'd just taken a chance and just, done volunteer work, I wish I'd done that. I wish I hadn't taken the safe road so many times. I mean, right out of school, of course, I got a job, a lousy job with a department store. But the point is, I went the safe route. I wouldn't give myself permission to really think about what did I really want to do? And was I willing to put in the work to uncover what I really wanted to do? Because it just doesn't pop up. You know, you turn 18, it's not just always right there, even 21. 25 is when I went into the FBI. So, I mean, it takes a while, but I wished I had been a little bit more adventurous and tried different things and maybe not got so bogged down in my own little world. And realize that there are so many people out there who need so much help that we are all capable of contributing to in some way.
And it's never too late for that.
Well, it isn't. That's exactly right. I mean, do you realize, Drew, that there are more slaves today than there were in 1860? I worked with the International Justice Mission for a while. I mean, as a consult. But I mean, we're talking in places of like India, where entire families are in indentured servitude, in Africa, in parts of Asia. I mean, we lament, and of course, the United States is not perfect, but there are so many people that are hurting in so many ways. And I would just like there to be more awareness on that.
Well said. What's next for you?
Well, I may try to get involved in one of those efforts to help. Like I said, when IJM is just one of many, many organizations that are really reaching out to try to help people, to help women. There's a goat program in Malawi where you can buy goats and give it to a woman. And with that goat, she's got food, she's got industry because she can sell cheese or whatever. I mean, there's just ways that don't hurt us that much. I mean, what does a goat cost? But we bought some goats for a family in Malawi. It's the poorest country in Africa. And I mean, those are the things we can do that are just, they're not going to make or break us here. It's just reaching out of our own little world. And I just see a lot of self-hate right now in America. And so maybe we should focus on ourselves maybe a little less and focus on how we can help people in other parts of the world more.
When you're in the zone, LaRae, what are you listening to? What's on your playlist?
Oh, I do like classical music. I have to admit, that's kind of an old standby. But I'm really liking jazz. And I'm listening to a lot of like Robert Plant and Alison Krauss and, you know, other artists in that same ilk, and maybe a little bluegrass, because I'm not listening to it that much. I kind of, you know, grew up on rock and roll, right? And oldies but goodies, right? But so that's a different type of music for me that I'm really liking. And then I just read. I love to read. It's just something that's always been a passion for me. So when I'm in the zone, I'm going to find a good book, and that'll keep me going for all summer.
Different answers, both in the musical selection, and we love avid readers. So, Lorrae, thank you so much.
Thank you, Yvonne. You and Drew have been just wonderful. It's really been a pleasure.
Yeah, I second that. And I just love your energy and your insight. And again, appreciate your time. And for our listeners out there, if you want to learn more, head to LorraeQuai.com. And we appreciate your presence today.
Thank you for asking me. And congratulations on your recent win.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone for tuning in. To the athletes, keep being the best you can be. Run your race with excellence. To the parents of athletes, let's continue to support our children with patience, grace, and understanding, learning to recognize how to truly become the guides and the stewards that we are supposed to be. To everyone, be willing to share your experiences to help others along their paths, and always be open to the wisdom that comes your way.
For more information about the 21 Podcast, 21 Media, and services provided by Train Harder 21, visit the website at drewlasker.com. And follow us across all social media platforms. Remember to add this podcast to your playlist, subscribe, rate, and review. Until next episode of 21, train harder.